Welcome back to In the Moment. Math is commonly considered a four-letter word, but instilling the next generation with strong math skills is a key part of maintaining a solid economy into the future. Travis Kowalski is professor of mathematics at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. He just won the Mathematics Association of America Regional Burton W. Jones Distinguished Teaching Award. Seth Keene teaches math at Stevens High School and is Rapid City's Teacher of the Year. Crystal McMacken is an eighth grade math teacher at Southwest Middle School and was recognized as an outstanding math teacher last year. SDPB's Kara Hetland recently spoke with all three of these educators about what it takes to get kids excited about math.
At what point do you really start to know when students are all in with math?
I can tell when they're all in because of the excitement in the room. When you walk in, it's actually loud and noisy, and the kids are all talking very excitedly. That's how I can tell they're really engaged in what we're doing.
Does it typically carry over then? Let's go to high school. Does that excitement carry over as math gets more difficult?
It certainly can, and I think that we see the same things that they would in middle school. The louder the room is, the better the lesson is going. I think at some point we do get to a point where we're doing some math that they don't see a use for in their everyday life, and sometimes that can be the brick wall that comes up. And so it's really our job as educators at that point to help them see those connections. Which sometimes can be a challenge, but it's also really exciting because then when they get it again after the brick wall stopped them, it might even be a more excited feeling for everyone.
Is there a certain kind of math, do you think, that has a more denser brick wall, maybe, that it takes? I have a daughter struggling right now in geometry, but she did really well in algebra, and I'm like, why can't you get your head wrapped around this?
And isn't it interesting that another parent would tell the same story with a flip-flop? You know, some people are better with the visual, you know, the shapes for geometry.
That was me.
And other people certainly enjoy working with and manipulating variables and working with equations. So it's to each his own or her own.
So then when it comes to STEM programming and the big capital M as math, how important then is this in carrying it on into the future? And I guess that just takes us to our college professor here.
Well, I'd make the argument that mathematics is nothing more than a language for patterns. It's a language for certain kinds of patterns that you'd see in the world around you. If it's patterns of numbers, we call it arithmetic. If it's patterns of shape, you'd call it geometry. If it's patterns of an argument, you'd call that algebra. And so any kind of sort of an engineering problem or any kind of technological innovation that you'd want to do is going to be taking things that you know from the real world, finding those patterns, and then being able to sort of push that pattern to the next level. And so mathematics is kind of this crucial underlying language to be able to do that. One of the difficulties of that students have with mathematics is if you frame it like that, if you frame it as a language, a lot of what you have to do in grade school and in middle school and high school is you have to learn the grammar of the language. And nobody in grade school ever goes at the end of a unit on sentence diagramming where they're putting the arrows at the nouns and the verbs and says, I want to do this for the rest of my life.
I did.
You are the first person.
I miss sentence diagramming. I'm not going to lie. I love the order to it. You know.
But sentence diagramming isn't quite what prepares you, say, for writing prose or poetry.
Right.
And mathematics kind of has that same thing. We spend a lot of time learning the grammar of mathematics and these different dialects for problems and different dialects for patterns. And if you only ever sort of think of it in the context of, oh, this is for this one kind of application and that application doesn't speak to you, it's really hard to want to invest time learning that language, learning that dialect, learning that diction for it. And so that's one of these sort of, you know, what makes certain things denser than other things is not a certain part of mathematics. It's whether or not the patterns that part of mathematics talks about, whether that kind of resonates with a student. I get a lot of students in college who are very, very good at high school mathematics, and so they go in with the computational skill set. And then when they find that a lot of sort of abstract mathematics isn't that computational skill set. They kind of move off into other applications where they can use the diction, use the grammar that they've learned to solve problems that they find more interesting. And then the flip side is we'll get lots of students who are mechanical engineers or electrical engineers who have to take mathematics to sort of learn how to articulate the world around them. And they end up really enjoying the patterns in the mathematics. And so they start to do more on the abstract side. So it's, you know, it's finding that right frame of pattern, that right bit of diction, that right bit of grammar that sort of resonates with the patterns that you find beautiful, that you find interesting in the world around you.
And is that a uniform language that's being taught?
I think we're making strides towards that. I know in the Rapid City area schools, we're dedicating a lot more time to more vertical alignment and certainly some horizontal alignment where we are trying to use the same language so that students don't get confused from one classroom to the other. But it's certainly a challenge because just like the English language, you know, if I go to the South and I order a Coke, that's a little bit different from Rapid City, South Dakota ordering a Coke. And yet we each think we're saying the right thing. So it's a challenge for sure.
So how do you bring math to life in the classroom?
Well, in the middle school, ours is more lower level, of course, than these two gentlemen are talking about. And so for me, to bring it to life is more we try to do problems that they would understand in the world that they would understand. So, so for example, in geometry transformations, we try to do pictures that they enjoy. So we might do cartoon characters and transform them. So we try to do things where the students can make a connection to what they're doing.
And I agree. And so it's not different for us, Crystal. I think just maybe the level of mathematics behind the problem increases just a little bit. But same thing, we're trying to meet them where they are and help them stick that to the Velcro that's in their brain from previous knowledge.
Yeah.
And then when they get to the college level, my job is to take those different parts of mathematics that they learned and find these unexpected connections between them so that problems that they thought at first glance were an algebra problem could also be a geometry problem or could also be a physics problem or could be something else. So it's all about finding that pattern, that Velcro on your mind to stick those things together with. And the more applications you've got, the more mathematics you've got at your disposal, the more likely you can find those patterns. And the trick is to find that right pattern, that right fit for the right student. And once it clicks, you know, something happens at that point. They realize it's not just symbols moving around on a piece of paper, that there's something more happening that we're telling a story about.
Give me an example of a real-life problem that students resonate with.
So I suppose we're doing, in probability and statistics, we're trying to find out if there's significant evidence of something being an unusual event. And so I'll get some statistics from the volleyball match the night before where Stevens played a certain opponent. And I'll talk about our serve percentage and how it's different from what our season-long average has been. But is it significantly different? And I think that that helps them buy in because I watched them all, you know, as the crazy student section watching that match. And they lived it. They saw that. And now they have a chance to reflect on that mathematically as statisticians rather than just student fans to say, wow, was that something special we saw? So I'd say that that would be an example of what we're talking about at the high school level.
At the middle school level, there's an activity we do where we look at sucker sales during the Valentine's Day season is pretty popular for a fundraiser. And so we talk about profit versus expenses and how much they should sell the suckers for to make a profit and what would be the break-even point compared to how many suckers they bought to what they're selling them for. So we find that break-even point. So they buy into that one because they're doing it at that moment.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I enjoy at the School of Mines, one of the parts of calculus is something called a series expansion. And the basic idea is to take some complicated expression and to write it like a very long polynomial. And we all know our polynomials from algebra. So if you can make something complicated into a polynomial, the problem solving becomes easier. But there's a lot of mechanics behind that that's really hard for students. And so this is me going in a different direction. Instead of finding mathematics that ties to something in the real world, I tie something from the real world into mathematics. I give students the analogy that the Taylor series that they're attempting to find is something akin to DNA for these functions. It lives inside the function. You can extract it. It's unique to a function. If you combine two functions algebraically, you combine their DNA. You can use DNA the same way that the FBI would solve a case, by taking out a piece of DNA, running it through a computer, and finding who it matches up to. There's a process called a power series solution, which involves taking an equation, extracting this DNA, plugging it into a computer, and seeing what function solves it. So this mirror image from the real world helps them to come up with, well, I know that this is true in the real world. I know that there's something called a recessive trait. Is there an analogy to that on the mathematics side? I know that there are people who have what's called chimerism, where they have two different sets of DNA in one human body. Is there something like that on the mathematics side? So it gets them interested in asking these questions, and the answers are always invariably yes. There are examples of these, and being able for a student to go from not knowing anything about it to having a little bit of an analogy to being able to make predictions about very unusual things that gave mathematicians over history, you know, fits and starts to solve is an amazing thing to kind of see happen.
These aren't things you can really Google.
And I think that
I mean, you can't really Google the answer,
right,
can you?
Right, and that's something actually that one of the folks that we brought in for some professional development this year, she said, you know, a valid question for your students is one that they can't find the answer to on Google. And that's something that's really driven my instruction all year.
Let's talk a little bit about the fast-paced tech economy, and how does math fit into that?
Well, mathematics is essentially an underlying language for any of the things that technology is either looking to solve or is being used to build. In the information technology, data mining is a big thing. We have oodles and oodles of data that we collect from, you know, from your online subscriptions to something, or the things that you pay with your club card. And so companies will have all of this data, thousands of dimensions of data. How do you analyze that? How do you find which parts of that data are useful, and then be able to extrapolate something from that? Certainly, we need computers, we need software and hardware to be able to do that, but the algorithms that those computers run are based on the mathematics of data analysis and of numeric approximation, of numeric visualization. So that's one of the biggest problems, is just the data mining problem. How do you take all of this data and isolate those important bits of it so that you could make predictions? And mathematics plays a huge role in both the theory behind that, but in also being able to code the algorithms that are needed to make the machines run. You know, computer scientists will hate it when I say this, but computer science is really just another part of mathematics. It's another language for problem solving. So they just happen to get paid better than we do.
And I think our district actually is a little ahead of the curve here. We saw that this data analysis was going to be such a big industry in the near future. I mean, currently and into the future. And so we've really incorporated that into all of our courses. We now teach an integrated math sequence for the first 3 years, in which at least a couple of chapters, if not more, are devoted to probability and statistics and analyzing that data. And we've now added an AP statistics class. I think we see this being such an important role in the future. So I'm excited by it, because it's something that I certainly love, and so I'm glad to see it.
And helping with maybe even to also understanding algorithms on Facebook, is that even a part of all of this as a conversation?
Yeah, being able to have, you know, you log into Facebook, you click on certain articles that you think are interesting, you click on some of the ads, and Facebook keeps track of that data. That data is then sent to the advertisers and the websites that run the articles that you're interested in, so that they can go and figure out what are some of the other things you might be interested in as well, so that your Facebook feed is, say, populated with things that you're going to find at least presumably more entertaining or more useful to you. This opens the doors to whether or not that kind of mathematical analysis is the right thing to go and do. Do you want your Facebook to be so micro-targeted that you're only in a certain political bubble, or that you're only seeing certain kinds of stories and missing the other things that are out there. But essentially, if it's a question that's I have information, what could I do with this? That's a mathematical question. The toolkit might change, and what you might need to get at that information will certainly change. But yeah, that's a valid mathematics question.
It is, although my students would tell me that Facebook is for old people, and so we talk about Netflix and the recommended next movie to watch, which also kind of skirts us around those ethical issues that you brought up. And but it makes me feel old because I use Facebook daily. But
you're right, though, they don't use it.
Well, but that brings up that this is the generation of students who will create that next thing.
And they are.
Right? And they are. So having that as a way to understand, to ponder, to ask questions.
Now, who knows what they're going to come up with? I mean, trying to figure out what's going to happen in 20 years' time anymore is sort of a fool's errand. You know, if we go back 20 years, the existence of a World Wide Web that somehow made obsolete every encyclopedia I've ever known, every newspaper I've ever bought, and somehow has all of the movies I've ever wanted to watch. Well, once upon a time, had all the movies I ever wanted to watch in one location at my fingertips. I would have thought you were crazy. Or the idea that I would carry a phone in my pocket that has more computational power than all of NASA had during the 1960s is bonkers. So, you know, what kids today who are growing up in this much smaller world that's connected by all of these sort of these digital fingerprints that can reflect certain parts of their personality, and how that's going to model the world that they're going to build. I'm excited to see what they're going to come up with, but I'm too old to be able to make claims as to what that will look like. I still use Facebook. I am a dinosaur too.
You know, and we've been talking about how we get students excited about math to move on into more STEM related professions, but let's flip it back. And I mean, you have to have your household budget as well. I mean, it's as basic as that, as you're an adult too.
Well, absolutely.
Okay, so the excitement. Tell me about your classrooms. We'll start middle school and go to college a little bit more as we finish this up. But just kind of paint me that picture of your classrooms and your students. And would you say they're all in, or does it take that special kind of student?
I would like to say they're all in. That's my end goal, is to get every kid excited about math. Typically, when they walk in the first day, math is not the class that they want to be in. And so my job is to make sure that math is the class that's enjoyable, they like it, they get to interact with each other, they get to interact with me, they get to interact with the mathematics, and it gets to be something that they enjoy. So if you walk into my room, we're sitting in groups. I give them an open-ended question that they may or may not know the answer to, that it's something you can't Google, and they will work on it in teams and try to figure it out. And it's a little messy, but that's a good thing.
And I think you wouldn't see too much of a difference at the high school either. We're going to try to give them that good, rich problem that's worth their time. And we do want to model how real mathematicians and statisticians work, and that is with, you know, other members of a group, and maybe I can serve a little bit more like a guide rather than the expert in front of them just trying to spoon feed it to them. I too would like to think that everybody was all in, but I think in high school, until you get to some of those elective courses at the junior or senior level, sometimes you don't get buy-in from everybody, and you do have a hard time meeting them where they are with their interests and their abilities. And so I think that's where you're going to start to hear quite a bit here in the near future about Rapid City area schools going towards something called the Pathways model. And we're going to attempt to give students an opportunity to experience the math and social studies and English and the art and everything that they study that can kind of be geared towards something they are interested in, so that you can get buy-in at the 9th and 10th grade level and not just wait until later. And I suppose at the college level, you're going to tell us the same thing, that, you know, sometimes when students have to take those prerequisites, they just kind of struggle through them until they get to that, you know, really perfect match of their interests.
Yep. Yeah. And you know, at the college level, I don't ever treat the idea that any of my students are all in at the beginning. I view them as seeing me as sort of antagonistic at that point. I'm one of the things that needs to get done so they can get to their engineering degree. Mm-hmm. But my goal in the class is to come in with interesting problems that tie to applications that are, in some sense, unscripted. I don't have them worked out sort of beforehand so that we can kind of work our way through it. And if a question that pops up as to how this was working or why we would do this, we could sort of follow some of those different paths and work our way towards answers kind of as a collective sort of talking and getting used to that language. Since I'm trying to impart train engineers, I have to start to get them to speak the language as well as be able to move the symbols around. One of the things, though, that I do at the college level that might be a little bit different than what happens at the grade school level or at the middle school level or at the high school level is at those lower levels, one of the things we try to do to get buy-in on the students is to show them how useful this object is, that there's a utility in knowing mathematics. When they get to college, they've been told that over and over again, and their engineering disciplines will in some sense prove that to them. So my job is maybe one of the last math people that they're going to talk to is to try to get them excited about it for any other reason than just its utility. Mathematics is the oldest language that we as a species agree on. You know, we may not agree on the words for number. We may not even quite agree on what some of these results mean, but we all sort of categorize number the same way. Every group of humans, every culture has sort of categorized our number sense the same way. We build our number words in the same etymological order. We stumble across the same theorems in kind of the same ways. There's something very human about that. And so one of the things I try to do is to put a little bit of that culture back into it. You know, everybody knows the Pythagorean theorem from geometry, but they might not know that it's actually a much older theorem that came from the Chinese that has something to do with the tangram puzzle that some kids play, or that has to do in India with building of sacred altars, that it's all part of this one common story, or that there are connections where it came from history. A lot of times when we teach mathematics, it's a 4,000-year-old subject, and we've got the hindsight of 4,000 years of trial and error, so we know logically the correct way to do these things. In college, I have a chance to do them not in the logical order, but maybe in the historical order, just to prove to students that, yeah, we didn't get it right all of the time. It's as much a trial and error empirical subject as anything else. But we don't a lot of times get a chance to do that before we get to college because there's so much grammar that we have to learn along the way. So the idea that it's this sort of human language that has some aesthetic parts to it, that has cultural tinges to it. And every time you write an equation down, the notion of writing it down is a Muslim tradition. The symbols we use are a Hindu tradition. The symbols in the middle come from Latin. The notions of how we write exponents or how we sort of organize our work has these little fingerprints from every culture that's sort of ever lived. And so being able to sometimes let students know that just in the equations they're writing down adds this kind of extra dimension that kind of helps to maybe convince them that if the applications aren't enough, there's a humanity behind it as well.
Well, they always say that it takes a very special teacher to light that spark in students for the interest to take a subject and go far with it. And our conversation today proves that the three of you are those teachers that make a difference. So I want to thank you all very much for taking the time and talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.